approach, a three-pronged approach to understanding what are what's a general framework for understanding quantum operations. Going beyond just unitary dynamics on our system and thinking, well, there's many more general things. I can think about them as evolution of a system that's coupled to some environment, which I then subsequently ignore. That allowed us to come up with a description of quantum operations in this form. But it was hard to see from that picture exactly what is the set of such operations that should be allowed. The operator sum representation is sort of the opposite. It gives you an explicit definition of here's the set of maps that can take density matrices to density matrices without really giving a lot of physical motivation. The main advantage to the operator sum representation is that it's a useful technical tool for expressing such maps. But then we showed those two things were equivalent, that you can express any coupling of a system to its environment in the operator sum representation, and that anything in the operator sum representation can be thought of as, let's take some hypothetical environment and couple it to it. What we're going to finish off with is to show that one can also take an axiomatic approach based just on what should be allowed by basically probability theory. So that was very much an approach we took with coming up with density matrices and mixed states and all possible measurements as POVMs. And we'll see that both of those things are really a special case of the axioms that we'll write down here for what are all the things that could happen just obeying the laws of probability theory. And what's quite remarkable is that that approach is completely equivalent to these other two, that you can, from this just probabilistic approach, you can always think, oh, there is some environment for which I'm coupled to that's leading to that particular dynamics. And it's remarkable that, that really this idea of coupling to an environment and thinking of some dynamics, unitary dynamics on a larger system, is enough to get every possible thing that is allowed by probability theory. So here's the axiomatic approach. We want to take some transformation, which takes in density matrices, spits out density matrices, described by some map, which is rho, goes to E of rho. And we say, what is the allowed set of E's? Can we come up with some axioms? Well, let's demand only that it maps density operators to other density operators. That is a very relaxed set of axioms. We just want to say, if what goes in is a density operator, what comes out has to be another density operator. What are all possible things of that form? So let's see if we can enumerate those specific axioms. OK, so if we have a density operator, it has to have trace 1. That's just an expression of probabilities of measurement outcomes of that system described by that density operator have to add up to 1. So we want what comes out to be a density operator. So we want the trace of E of rho to equal 1 for all rho. And so we say such a map is trace preserving, abbreviated just TP. A TP map is one that if you give it a trace 1 operator, it spits out a trace 1 operator. We want this map to be convex linear in the following sense. If I think of my input state as some distribution over density matrices, then I can think of that as, oh, I've sampled rho I from the probability distribution Pi, and I can imagine actually doing that sampling and sending in states rho I. And I want the map to satisfy that E on this convex combination should be the convex combination of E on the elements of that ensemble. So this is necessary for the rules of probability to be preserved under our, if you want to call it evolution, or our, just our whatever our update is, our change. And that idea of linearity, so that's what I was referring to right back in those first lectures when I say I want things to be linear. That's not a linearity on the Hilbert space, though you can require that of certain things. Here, the linearity we want to preserve the rules of probability is linearity on this space of operators. And so, and it's specifically that we want sort of this convex linearity, which I guess is maybe a slightly more stringent condition than just imposing linearity. But often people just refer to that as linearity. That's what we mean. It preserves the rules of probability. That would be good. So by the way, if you ever then see anything in quantum mechanics, I mean, people say quantum mechanics is linear, but it's often said that, well, we can study nonlinear extensions to quantum mechanics or put in some nonlinearity to try to think about what will happen. And whenever you see that type of thing, you should be very skeptical about whether, you know, the rules of probability are going to be preserved under that modification you've made to the to quantum mechanics. So I'm not saying that it's never possible or that that's not an interesting avenue of research, but one should be very skeptical whenever you hear of nonlinearity in that sense in quantum mechanics, that you should ask what's happening to just the rules of probability. Okay. And what other conditions do we have on density operators? Well, density operators have to be positive. They have to have non-negative eigenvalues that can be viewed as probabilities. So we want to enforce that the output state is positive, right? So this we would call positivity. It turns out that this condition here is not quite enough, because we want to ensure a positivity type of condition, but we are going to think about a more general one than just that the output state has to be positive. We want our description to be valid when it's part of a larger system. So we can imagine, I'm now extending this figure up at the top, that we have some system and some other part of the system which is not being acted upon. That these this system and some sort of reference here might start in some initial, possibly entangled density matrix rho SR. What comes out when only system S is transformed under this map is some new, again, possibly entangled rho prime SR. And of course, we want that to be a valid map. Maybe put another way is that we want this idea of our axiomatic definition of allowed maps to be composable. If I say this is an allowed map, then the map acting on system S and doing nothing to system R, that bigger map should also be an allowed map. And asking for positivity of this map is not enough to ensure that. So we're going to cross out that definition and write a more stringent one, that E tensor I, which is a tensor product of such maps on some larger operator space. Now we take some positive operator A on that, which could be a density matrix, and we want that to be positive whenever A is positive, on that A is acting on SR. For all possible reference systems R. So this, we give it a different name. We call this, instead of just positivity, we call this complete positivity. Or CP. And that's going to be our third condition. Let me just make a little aside on over here to give you an example of a map which is positive but not completely positive. Just to show that it's actually strictly a stronger requirement to demand complete positivity than just positivity. And such a map is given by the transpose. I can take a density matrix, and just here's the map I'm going to define. Take that density matrix to its transpose. Not its Hermitian conjugate, it's a Hermitian matrix, but to its transpose. That you can check if rho is positive, then rho transpose is necessarily positive. But if rho is the reduced density matrix of a larger state, and I take just the transpose of the system and do nothing to the reference with which it's entangled, then doing what you might call the partial transpose on the system and not on that reference is not a positive operation. So, but partial transpose, by that I mean transpose on S, but identity on R is not positive. And it's a good exercise to check that if I take a Bell state or an entangled state, maximally entangled state, on SR. So if I made S just a qubit, R is another qubit, make a Bell state, take the partial transpose on S but not on R of that state, I will get a state which is not positive. It will have negative eigenvalues. It's not a state. Okay, so that's a good exercise to try. But there's an example of an operation which you might think is allowed if we had this more relaxed positivity condition, but is going to be ruled out by this complete positivity condition. Okay, so the axiomatic approach says, let's think of all maps that define these three axioms. We call these CP, TP, and I'll write in brackets linear, because that's another condition, maps. But often in quantum mechanics, we just assume linearity for everything, so it often goes unmentioned. CP, TP maps, completely positive trace preserving maps. That's the set of operations which we could axiomatically define as being allowed in quantum mechanics, and take that as our definition of the allowed operations. Now, what we're going to show, remarkably, is that that is exactly matched up with, it's exactly equivalent to those other conditions we've written. That if a map is CPTP, then it has an operator, some decomposition, and we can think about it as coupling that system to some environment and then discarding that environment. And that's quite remarkable. Okay, so let's show that. Equivalence of approaches. So here's a theorem which will prove a linear map E is CPTP if and only if it has an operator sum representation. For sum over k, ek, dagger, ek, equals I. Okay, so that will, this theorem will prove equivalence to the operator sum representation. And yesterday, we proved equivalence of operator sum representation with this coupling to the environment. So then we have a complete set of equivalences. Okay, so let's prove this. It's some useful techniques in this proof. In part because what you know, saying okay, CPTP maps. Okay, well that's fine. What is that set? If I wanted to write down a good CPTP map, how would I do that? The goal of this equivalence is to say, well, operator sum representations are the right way to write CPTP maps, and to understand how the operator sum representation demands complete positivity and trace preservingness and so on. Those are useful techniques for then working with the operator sum representation. Okay, so we're going to do this proof in two parts, proving the if and then proving the only if. Okay, so step one, suppose has an operator sum decomposition. Then we're going to prove that it's a CPTP linear map, that it satisfies those three axioms. Okay, so it's quite obviously linear. And the trace preserving condition follows trivially from just the fact of those sum to identity terms. So that's, we're not even going to sketch out the details. That's very easy to show. All we're going to have to do is then check that it's completely positive. That's the trick. Okay, so here's how we'll do that proof. Basically, we're going to have to say, give it some positive operator, rho. Then we just have to show that E of rho is a positive operator. When rho is part of any larger system. Sorry, that's the key point in complete positivity. So let A be a positive operator on system reference, where we can make that reference as big as we want, arbitrary. So psi will be some state on system reference. Let's define a set of states given by acting with these adjoint operators, identity on R on this state. Then we can check that, okay, so this is an arbitrary state on system and reference. Here is how the operator sum representation acting on A is acting, given that only part of it is S and part of it is R. And we're looking at, you know, sort of the expectation value of what comes out of that map for some arbitrary state. If that's going to be positive for all states, then we're going to be all right. Okay, so this is given by this, which is going to be positive. And that means if I say for this arbitrary state, E tensor I, that's how the map acts on system and reference. For some arbitrary positive A on system and reference, that just turns out to be a sum of these terms, each of which is positive. So that turns out to be positive for all states psi. Therefore, E tensor I acting on a positive operator is a positive operator. Any questions with that? So that proof technique basically says the operator sum representation is good. It takes positive operators to positive operators. But even if we can think of it as just acting on part of a larger space, it takes positive operators on that larger space to positive operators on that larger space. And that just is true for any map that's written in that operator sum representation form. It's just the form of that operation that gives that proof. Questions? Everyone happy with that? So the converse is a bit trickier. So to prove the converse, so that's where we say, let's assume that we have a map that's CPTP that's satisfying those axioms. Let's try to say there exists a operator sum representation. So this part of the proof introduces some new techniques, which we'll explore on the next slide after completing this proof. Okay, so let's introduce a reference system, which is the same size, basically isomorphic to the system itself. So if the system's a qubit, we're going to take the reference system to be a qubit. That's going to be sufficient for proving the existence of this operator sum representation. Let's pick a basis for the system. And we can pick a basis for the reference system labeled by the same index, because it's basically an identical system. And let's construct the following vector in the Hilbert space of RS, which is going to look like an entangled state, but it's we're not going to normalize it. It's an unnormalized state. Now let's define an operator which lives on SR, which is given by acting with ES identity on R on this state as an operator. Now here's the thing that we're going to show that's sort of quite remarkable, and then we're going to explore it on the next slide, that this operator is completely sufficient to specify that CPTP map. It contains all of the information of that CPTP map. And so we're going to then be able to use properties of that operator to construct the operator sum representation out of it. So that's going to be sort of quite surprising, that if I think of a CPTP map, it's sort of like, OK, it's a map that can take any, maps all possible quantum states to quantum states. Why should it be that I can map this particular quantum state? Well, unnormalized, but it's basically like a maximally entangled state. Why is it I can take this particular one and act on it with that operation, and that still has all the information about that operation in it? Normally, you would think acting with a map on just one element is that what you get out of that is not enough to reconstruct the map. But we're going to show that it is in this case. So let's consider some system state psi. Let's just write it out in this basis. And now I'm going to take a state on the reference system, and that's going to look very odd. I'm going to take the state, which is the complex conjugate of the coefficients in this basis, and write that out as a state. So that's normally, it's not an operation that you do in quantum mechanics. But it nonetheless, for any state on the system, that defines a state on the reference. Taking the complex conjugate of those coefficients, that's the you know, if I want to think of a map from there to there, that's a basis dependent map. If I wrote it out in a different basis, it wouldn't look like just complex conjugates of the components. Okay, so what we're going to show is we're going to take this state on R and act on this operator sigma. That's going to give an operator on S. Let's see what that operator looks like. Okay, let's plug in the definition of what is sigma sub SR, and let's expand it out so we're going to plug in that, but let's plug in for alpha, let's plug in that expansion, that particular expression up there. So recall that it's E acting on a specific state, which I can write out in our basis as E acting on all possible terms that look like ij on the system, tensor I, I. I j on the reference. So that's just expanding out what is E. Closing the brackets there, not there. E is acting just on the system. The reference is along for a ride, and we've written it out in that specific basis. Let's use that expression for psi tilde of R, which is also in that same basis that allows us to kill off a whole bunch of terms. We get psi j star E on I s j. And then we can put those coefficients inside. And now we can think of this as E acting on the state psi on s.
Why do we expand E in the base with those operators? But
it's not any expansion so much as just, remember, sigma is just defined as E tensor I acting on this entangled state.
Okay.
And the entangled state is written out as that sum of, in that basis. And so all I'm doing is just plugging in the expression for alpha, and that's how it looks as a density operator. But all of that is just a trick to show how this thing thought of as an operator on a system is actually, you know, the operator on a system that you get when you act with that map on psi for some arbitrary psi. So there you can see how this operator sigma really does have all the information you need about describing psi, because if I want to see how what the map is on psi, I just take this other state on the reference, psi tilde, take the expectation value of that state, and it spits out the output of the map E when acting on the input psi. So what we'll finally do is just say, okay, that operator has in it everything we want about the action of the map on some arbitrary state. What we're going to do now is just decompose this operator into something that looks like the operator sum representation, and then we'll be able to identify that there is an operator sum representation associated with that map. So let's decompose sigma r into some SR into some eigenbasis, sum over K, SK, SK. Remember, this is on a system and R. So that's just an eigenbasis of that operator. And let's those things don't have to be normalized. And then now let's define these operators acting on some general state on the system. This is just defining a linear map given by, let's take these S's, which are SKs, which are on the system and reference, and let's act on it with this tilde operator. If I do that, now it's just a matter of expanding out what is sigma SR and the expectation of it in these states on the reference system. And I just realized I have an S there. That should be an R. I just fixed that there, sorry. Now if I expand out what this is, then I'll see I just get something that looks like an operator sum representation. So this gives, on the one side, I can plug in that decomposition of sigma SR, and I get that this looks like sum over K EK psi EK dagger. And we've proven that that thing equals the map acting on the general state psi on S. So voila, we have our operator sum representation. We've defined it there just on pure states, but remember we're trying to show that the axiomatic formulation reproduces the operator sum. One of the axioms was that it's convex linear. So we've defined how that map acts on all pure states. We can extend it by convex linearity to all mixed states. So we've said, let's just start with a map that's CPTP. And we've proven it has an operator sum representation. So now we have both sides of this relation, if and only if, so we have an equivalence.
What have we used that it's CP?
Where have we used that it's completely positive?
We're using sigma SR is positive. What?
So.
Where?
Yeah, I must be here when we choose the
fact that
this thing has this, which is a positive operator, means that I can have that. You know, I've done an eigen decomposition, but I've incorporated the eigenvalues into the state, so I don't have any negative coefficients. Did you have a question?
Yeah. So not really sure from the expression that you wrote for EK that it's well defined, like it doesn't seem obvious to me.
Oh, yeah. So this is a okay. So here I've tried to say that this is a linear map on states given by this, and is it obvious that that's going to be linear on? Yeah. So that's, I mean, it's part of the trick in taking this complex conjugate, I guess, is you want to show that it's going to be okay. So what you would do is define the map for all the our chosen basis states, when in which case it's fine, and then you want to say, okay, well, can I make that a linear map that acts on all states? That's really where this complex conjugate comes in. You'll find that if I want to now act on something with with two different components in that basis, the way I have to combine those maps is to use that complex conjugate there. So that's how you do it. It's just define it in that basis and then show that to extend it to a full linear map, I have to have that complex conjugate. That's where it really comes in, the need for that. OK, so I mean, you're picking up on the right thing. You sort of say, well, there's something deeper in this trick that we've used. This idea of working with this maximally entangled state on the system and the reference, and then thinking of these weird complex conjugated states on the reference and so on. Is there something going on here that is allowing us to follow this proof technique? And yeah, so let me, I mean, there is. There's something more general here, quite a useful technique, which actually provides a isomorphism between all CPTP maps, all maps that take density operators on a system to density operators on a system. There's an isomorphism between those valid quantum operations and maximally entangled states on two copies of the system, or if you like it this way, a system and a reference of equivalent size. And maybe let's explore what that isomorphism is, the one that says really that there is a state on a system in reference, here this thing sigma, which is given by this operation of the CPTP map on half of an entangled state. And in that state is all the information about that map. And in fact, I should be able to go from that state back to the map, which is really what we've constructed here. OK, so let's just explore that a bit, because there's quite a bit more to it, and it's a useful technique. So this is really an isomorphism between operations and states. And it goes right back to a very simple isomorphism that was it's originally due to Choi, which is just an isomorphism between operators on some space A and vectors on A tensor A, two copies of A. And the isomorphism is actually, it's incredibly simple. If you just pick a basis, it's going to be a basis dependent isomorphism. Here's a basis of operators on A in Dirac notation. And it's pretty obvious that I can put those in one-to-one correspondence with states on A cross A by just writing I tensor J. That's the isomorphism. It's basis dependent, as written out by Choi. There's an alternative way to actually write the isomorphism between operators on A and vectors on A tensor the dual of A. So you don't even flip around. I mean, then the isomorphism looks like I, J, and as I is a ket, J is a bra, and I is a ket, tensor J is a bra, which actually looks almost silly when you write it out in Dirac notation, because we make that identification all the time. But let's stick to this one by Choi. It makes things a bit basis dependent, which is why sometimes things look odd and you see complex conjugates in a few odd spots. But then we define an unnormalized maximally entangled state like we did before. Sorry. That's just an isomorphism between operators and vectors. What we're trying to do here is find an isomorphism between operations, which are maps from operators to operators, and density matrices on systems and references. So it's a bit of an extension from this original one by Choi, but it follows just by convex linearity. So let's define this thing that looks like an unnormalized maximally entangled state on two copies of the system, A prime and A. A prime tensor A. Why did I write things in that order? Let's see where we go with this. So this is unnormalized. So consider a CPTP map, i.e. a quantum operation. Why does it grow like that sometimes? AB, which takes, density matrices on A to density matrices on B. My mind wants to write beta for some reason. Density matrices on A to density matrices on B. We haven't talked about this so far, actually. We've always mapped sort of the system onto itself. But all of the framework that we've done extends quite naturally to mapping from one system to a different system, even a system of different dimension. Here, we're going to pick those things to be the same dimension. So really, they're isomorphic systems. But it's useful to think of them as two parties. Especially when we see a connection of this isomorphism with quantum teleportation. So there's a map that takes density matrices on A to density matrices on B, an equivalent size system. And let's define a state on AB. It's not really a state because it's not going to be properly normalized. But otherwise, it is positive, and that's all we really need. So there's my map. We want this operation taking A prime to B and doing nothing to system A on this maximally entangled state on A prime A. So this is exactly what we did in the previous proof. So we note that rho AB is positive, and the trace on system B of rho AB, the partial trace, is the identity on A, which tells me that it's not properly normalized. Because now if I completed the total trace and took the trace over A, I wouldn't get 1, I'd get D. Okay, so strictly what we have here, and I'm not going to go into the details of the proof of the relation, but I'd rather just present it, is we're going to have an isomorphism between the set of all quantum operations that are CPTP maps and positive operators on two copies of the system, AB, that satisfy this trace condition. So that's going to be the isomorphism. To really say we have a good isomorphism, I should have the reverse map. So how do we go the other way? How do we, given the state, reconstruct what is the map? Well, here's the expression. The map from A to B on some state of system A will be given by, let's take that state of system A and tensor it with rho on A prime B. And then let's take the expectation, on just A prime in this unnormalized maximally entangled state on A prime. So I'm not going to prove it, but this is actually an isomorphism. For any state that's positive and satisfies this trace condition, this will give a valid CPTP map. For every valid CPTP map, then this thing is a positive operator satisfying this trace condition. And you can go back and forth, yeah?
Why did you exchange A prime and A into the last line?
Yeah, sorry. I won't try to do it now, but somehow I've flipped around my A's and A primes. But I think it's at least each expression is consistent,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so here, I mean, I have A first and then A prime. So I'm trying to keep the ordering of things. Apologies. Okay, so there's actually a nice interpretation of this. So it says that we can, this isomorphism allows us to say, how can I represent a CPTP map? Well, act on half of a maximally entangled state, and the resulting state that you get encodes all of the information about that map. So that's actually practically quite useful when I'm trying to, like, for example, do a calculation where I'm attempting to show a map written out maybe as some giant matrix that acts on vectors in the operator space. Maybe I'm coding up something in MATLAB. I want to show that it's a valid CPTP map. All I have to do is construct this isomorphic state and then check its conditions, positivity in this trace condition. Okay. So we have a lot of tools for saying, is this a valid state? Those are very easy things to do in MATLAB. And so you can do all sorts of checks. And so it's often easier to work with that isomorphic state than it is with the original map. So I can take with that map, act on half an entangled state. There's a state that encodes all the information of that map. How can I think of that map? How can I think of that state? How can I interpret that state? Well, this provides a bit of a picture. So think back to how we described quantum teleportation, where we had some unknown quantum state of Alice, and then she had an entangled state between her other system A prime and a remote party B. Here, if that CPTP map was the identity, this would be such a maximally entangled state. And then she performed an entangling measurement on her systems A and A prime. So one of the outcomes involves projecting onto this particular entangled state. She might perform that entangled basis measurement and post-select only the outcomes when she got that particular measurement outcome. And then she said, oh, what happened was the resulting state on Bob was the original state that I had on A. So if that map is the identity, then this thing tells me that basically quantum teleportation occurs. If I take the case where I don't have to do any correction to that final state, that's post-selecting out that one outcome, then whatever is here in this part on system A pops out over here with the identity map on system B. Now, what if it's not the identity map? Well, it says, oh, well, OK, now I've taken my entangled state. I've acted on that entangled state with my map. Now I have this thing, which is encoding the information of the map. It might not be a maximally entangled state. It might not be an entangled state at all anymore. But if I try to use that to do teleportation, what pops out the other end on Bob's system? Not the original state, but the transformed state under that map. So that isomorphism viewed as in this language of teleportation through the map, is an incredibly good one conceptually. This is also a commonly used technique in quantum computing where we can do quantum gates, transformations on a system, not by acting directly on the system, but by acting on half of entangled states. You're sort of storing up a gate in a maximally entangled state, and then using teleportation to send a quantum system through that gate through teleportation. So that's pretty cool. Any questions on that? The language in quantum information is people often call that the Choi isomorphism or the Choi J. Milkovsky isomorphism. Apologies for the pronunciation. In reference to these original isomorphisms developed by Choi. But those original ones were on a different space. I've gone on for almost an hour, and I've just finished the last bit of yesterday's lecture. But that's OK. We're going to start now on quantum measurement. And if we don't get it through all through today, we'll continue on Monday. And this is going to be a bit shorter anyway. The goal here will be to look now with this formulation of quantum operations as CPTP maps, as operator sum representation, as coupling with an environment, and now start thinking about the special case where that operation might be viewed as a measurement in some form. And we'll see what we can say, what we can't say, what are some of the pitfalls. And we'll also explore the sort of full, well, we won't explore the full range of possible measurements, because that's huge, but we'll certainly explore a bit more of the range of what you can do with measurements with this expanded general picture. So let's start off with developing something that is a nice, simple model due to von Neumann for quantum measurement as a quantum operation. And so many of you will have seen this before, and I'm going to sketch it out. And then we're not going to go through it in detail. We're going to look at an alternative way of, well, not an alternative of way, but an alternative formulation of this particular measurement. But this is the standard one, von Neumann measurements. So let's take two quantum systems. So we have a system, and we have an environment. But we're now going to think of this as some sort of measurement device or meter. For the example we're going to consider here, von Neumann described, this is a quantum system with one degree of freedom, I just want to take a system with position and one degree of position, one degree of momentum, standard Hilbert space, L2 of R. We have position operators on the measurement system, and a momentum operator on the measurement system. That's going to be my specific quantum system for the measurement device. What is the quantum system S? That could be anything at the moment. Here's a description for how we can think of using a quantum system as a measurement device to learn something about a system. Let's initialize M in a Gaussian state or wave function with mean 0. Let's make that general. Let's take it with mean x naught. So we can think of, maybe a bit abstractly, given that we've explored a more rigorous way of doing functions on this infinite dimensional space. Loosely, we can think of expanding out this general Gaussian state in a eigenbasis of position eigenstates, where 5x is a Gaussian with standard, with mean 0. Mean x naught and standard deviation delta x. Then we want to measure an observable A on S. Let's use an interaction between the system and the measurement device that will look like some coupling that we can turn on and then turn off that couples that observable of the system to the momentum operator of the measurement device. And we're going to think of some impulsive measurement, meaning that that chi of t is basically zero, except for some small interval, zero to t naught, the time in which we're going to allow them to couple. And we're going to integrate that up and just call that g. It's like a coupling coefficient. So that allows us now to talk about the unitary transformation given by that coupling rather than solving for it at all time. We'll just think of it as the unitary given by that impulse. So if the system state is initially psi s is sum over a, psi of a, where this is the eigenbasis of a, then what's going to happen when we couple them? Well, this will evolve to e to the minus I g a tensor m or pm. And this is equal to sum over a that operator acts as a displacement operator that displaces the system. If the system is in an eigenstate with eigenvalue a, then the measurement device is displaced in position by an amount ga or minus ga. So for having that Gaussian distribution go to zero, we find that this goes to something like having the position eigenstate that it was originally in at zero or at x naught now displaced by GA depending on the eigenvalue of the system that we measured. Of course, what we actually have here is an entangled state between the system and the meter. So you would have to conclude this process by saying, let's measure the meter and learn something about the system. Now, here's where I want to, that's the standard framework, and I wanted to sort of outline it. But here's where we want to deviate a bit from our investigation. We'd like to understand a bit about what's going on in this process, and in particular, what happens when this standard deviation is not zero. What happens when we maybe measure in different bases of this meter, or maybe we just trace out the meter? What's the range of possibilities that we can get out from this basic coupling? And if you do it within this picture of functions on L2 of R and position eigenstates and so on, there's a lot of distracting details about just the fact that that's an infinite dimensional space, that those position eigenstates are not even really well defined in that space, and so on. There's a bunch of distracting details that are obscuring the fundamental part of this problem. So in order to make things a bit clearer, we're going to look at a finite dimensional analog of this that doesn't have any of those problems. We're going to reduce, by going to a finite dimensional system, we're going to reduce the sort of the number of different parameters, the degrees of freedom by which you could change things in this measurement problem, constrain it down a lot. such that it's going to be much easier to sort of pick out the relevant details for understanding, okay, when do we get something that looks like a projective measurement? When do we get something that looks a bit like a weak measurement where we only gain partial information about the system? When will I see disturbance on a system and how can I quantify that disturbance? Those are all the types of things that we want to do. So that's not to say that this von Neumann framework, I mean, we're essentially working in a von Neumann framework in the next as well. It's just in a finite dimensional scenario. But this one of coupling it to what's essentially an oscillator system, what's good about it is it really gives a dynamical picture of what's going on. I can really think of, you know, what's going on in terms of position and back action on other systems. That dynamics is helpful. We're going to have to try a bit harder in our finite dimensional system to think about that dynamics. But nonetheless, there's a lot of advantages for just restricting to a finite dimensional scenario when trying to weed out the key details. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. I'm going to try to now construct a much simpler finite dimensional qubit version of a von Neumann measurement. And then we're going to explore that in the ideas of weak measurement. And what we learn will have relevance to this problem, but it's easier to see it in nice, simple linear algebra than worry about some of the details in this. Does that make sense? Nobody's too upset by putting that example behind us. Okay, so let's take a simple qubit measurement model. Meaning two-dimensional system. So now our system that we're going to measure is a qubit. We'll label it states. I mean, it can be pure or mixed. We also have another qubit, which will serve as our measurement device. So here's what we're going to do with this qubit. And now, rather than think about I'm measuring position observables or so on, like in the last problem, let's think of initializing in some almost general state chi, which will be a superposition state, but not have, it'll be just real coefficients. Making complex coefficients here doesn't really add anything. So I'll make that simplification. We're going to initialize in that state. Ultimately, we're going to have to measure this system. So we're going to measure in a different basis. So we're going to measure in a basis given by another angle, eta. The orthogonal state to that, corresponding to the outcome 1, will be minus sine eta 0 plus cos eta 1. And of course, we want to put in some coupling that's an analogy to that coupling we had in the von Neumann measurement that loosely we want to think of as four different eigenvalues of some observable on the system, we want to change the state of our measurement device. If we're imagining trying to do measurements in the 0-1 basis of the system, could be strong projective measurements, could be weak measurements, but nonetheless, we pick that as the observable of the system that we're trying to measure, want to measure sort of z of the system, learn something about whether it was in a state 0 or 1, then a good coupling that we could choose, we're going to couple with the so-called C-naught operation from quantum computing, which is a unitary, which, I mean, you can sort of, if you squint and think about it, is actually quite a good analogy to that coupling we had in the previous model. If the system's in the state 0, Don't do anything to the measurement state, leave it where it is. If the system is in the state 1, then we're going to change the state of the qubit with the Pauli X operator. So you can check that that's a unitary operation. I've written it in a way that makes it suggestive of a classical conditional story. If it's 0, then do this. If it's 1, then do this. But of course, that's a coherent operation. That's a unitary. And so it's perfectly valid to say, well, the input state could be a superposition of 0 and 1, in which case it doesn't have as simple a classical story. OK, let's see what happens when we apply our framework to this particular setup. So we get measurement operators, which are just the operators in the operator sum representation. We're now just thinking of them as associated with measurement rather than something else. OK, so for 0, can I write this in a, no, I have to write it separately for each. That involves an operator where we imagine coupling the system and meter with U. The meter was initialized in the state chi, and then finally we measure it in the eta basis and get the 0 outcome. You can check that this is just nice and simple in this way. So that's an operator acting on a system that describes what happens if the meter prepared in chi after coupling with the system gets measured in the eta basis and we get the 0 outcome. Then there's another one for 1. Oops. Sorry, it's a bit slow, but we need these details for quite a few things, so let's be explicit. OK, what does this mean in terms of dynamics for the system? The system, in some initial state, pure or mixed, whatever, evolves to a final state, which is going to be in the operator sum language, a sum over mi, rho s mi dagger, which, if I know what measurement outcome occurred on I've measured the meter, the measurement device state, n not or 1. I know what outcome is occurred. I then condition, I update what that transformation is on a system with that measurement result. If m equals 0, I now have the state m naught rho m naught dagger on trace of m naught dagger m naught rho. And that occurs with probability P naught equals what's in the denominator. And there's another outcome. Good. Can I think of that that process as a measurement? Yes, it has a POVM where those POVM elements can be expressed in terms of the measurement operators. And here they look like almost the same expression, but with squares. And Okay, so I wanted to write this out all in gory detail because we're going to refer back to this a few times. So if you guys have written all that out, when I refer back, you'll be able to check. But now we're going to sort of think through some of the special cases. Sorry, question?
It's just about like the situation that this is describing. So it's, you still have to measure the second qubit though, right?
Yes.
So like, this is just what, a situation where you don't know how to measure in the lab the observable of your first qubit that you want to know about, but you do have a second probe qubit that you know how to measure in some basis, and then what the idea is like.
I mean, part of the purpose here is we've introduced back in the first or second lecture the idea of a quantum measurement as sort of the end of the road. I do a POVM, I get an outcome with some probability, but I don't ask anything about now what's the quantum state of the system. So I don't have to invoke anything about wave function collapse or something like that. I just I have a rule. Which says, I measure this system, here are the outcomes I can get. Now done, I never talk about that system again. Now, if we want to think about measurement in a way in which we haven't destroyed the system, in various forms, people talk about these as quantum non-demolition measurements. We haven't destroyed the system, we could talk about what is the state of the system after I've measured it. Then I need I want to be able to derive that sort of thing from the axioms that I've had. I have an axiom that tells me measurement's the end of the road. Can I build up a measurement where it's not the end of the road with that while you couple it to another system? So that's one reason to do this. But the other is that it will allow us to explore some aspects of the range of possible measurements and the range of updates on the system. As a result of the details of that coupling and what we do to this measurement device. So that will also turn out to be quite illustrative. We can study not only do what we learn about a system through various types of measurements, but also in what way that system is disturbed. Do I collapse its wave function to a particular state? Do I just nudge it only slightly when I try to get a bit of information out of it? It provides a more general framework to talking about that measurement process, not as the end of the road, but as a quantum operation itself. So that's the goal. Does that answer your question?
Kind of.
You could, if you want, construct, different axioms where you put in the possibility for this type of more, a measurement in the system keeps going right at the beginning. But we haven't done that. I think it's nice to sort of see that we can just postulate what measurement is as sort of not having to think about something to do with wave function collapse, but just the end of the road. I've done something very different that's not unitary dynamics on the system, but I'm not going to get too worried about that because I never have to talk about that system again once I've done this measurement. And I feel more satisfied starting with that axiom and then showing that more general types of things is possible within this quantum operations framework.
Yeah, like this is just like a more practical construction that relates to like lab situations better, right?
Well, that's also, so I haven't mentioned that, but certainly, this has suddenly become a very popular subject with a lot of quantum laboratories around the world, as they really start thinking in detail about what is quantum measurement on a system and how am I doing it, and what's the range of types of measurements I can do, and how does that affect my system, then they've really started to explore these types of measurement models. And then maybe just to highlight, and we'll come back at it a few times, the quantum operation formalism, if you trace over the final state of the system without, the measurement device, without measuring it first, that quantum operation is described by this, where you don't know, in a sense, what outcome you've measured. What we're talking about here is something different than the quantum operations formalism. We're imposing on it that there's also a measurement on M that it's then going to choose through some nonlinear process either this outcome or this one. And that is selecting out a particular element out of this ensemble for the system. Yeah?
Why did you say it's a nonlinear process?
Yeah, it's not a linear map with this sort of, well, it's not convex linear.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, let's just look at one. Well, it is Friday. It's 12:10. Yeah, let's come back to this on Monday and then treat things properly. I don't want to rush through something in 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, so thanks everyone. Have a good weekend, and let's pick this up again on Monday.